Well, I'll start out by telling you who I am, very briefly. My name is Walter Stewart, and at Holden, I'm listed simply as theologian. I make my living by being president of Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley. And before I did that, I was a parish pastor and a seminary professor in the area of ethics, specifically. I look at being at Holden as an opportunity, among other things, to give some second thoughts to matters that really deserve second thoughts, but which in our real life, as someone referred to it this morning, doesn't provide time or occasion to do that. And sometimes the things that deserve second thoughts don't really seem to fit into this context. And yet, being here does give us the time and the opportunity to do it. And so this morning, and then for the next 3 days, I want to give some second thoughts to a book that I've recently read. Not just second thoughts to the book itself, but because the book has caused me to give some second thoughts to some other things, and then those second thoughts on other things bring me back to the book. So we want to do what may seem like going around in circles. I want to look at the book, to think a little bit about that, and then to look at some theological doctrines or understandings which seem to connect with the thought in the book, to give some thought to the theological doctrines, and then perhaps, on the basis of that, come back to the subject of the book. Thinking in circles may seem like not getting us anywhere if we keep coming back to the same point. But on the other hand, it may be that by coming back to the same point a number of times, we do in fact make some progress and move on, not progress on a particular subject. The book that is stimulating my thinking, and I hope will stimulate yours, is The Fate of the Earth by Jonathan Schell. I've written the title and the author up here. The Fate of the Earth by Jonathan Schell. That's S-C-H. The Fate of the Earth first appeared as a series of three articles in the New Yorker magazine, Fate of the Earth. It costs $11.95, but as Mary Schramm said, and I agree, it's well worth the price. On the other hand, you can get it less expensively. As far as I can tell, it's word for word the same thing. Schell is a staff writer for the New Yorker. So the book is written by a person who professionally is a writer. On the other hand, I feel that he has spoken as a philosopher, a scientist, and certainly a theologian, and as a person who lives on this earth. I'm not going to try to review or study the whole book. I certainly would encourage you to do that yourself. But to pick out from each of the three chapters what has been a particularly provocative thought or theme for me. On the fourth day, on Friday, then I want to take a statement that has been proposed by one of the Lutheran churches. It's the LCA Statement on World Community, which I feel is an attempt by the church to deal with this particular subject. But I don't want to get us thinking in institutional terms until we've had some time to think out of the context of Jonathan Schell and our own experience. The way the schedule is set up, tomorrow's session will be at 4, and then on Thursday and Friday, again at 10:45. And I think all but the Friday session are in this room. The Friday one, I believe, is in the Village Center. But if you regulate your day like mine, you go to the bulletin board to see where you're supposed to be and what you're going to be doing. Okay. Now, this morning, what I'd like to do, then, is to start by describing what I think the author is saying in a particular section of the first chapter of The Fate of the Earth. And then to draw a connection between what the Luther is saying, what the author is saying, and a segment of scripture, which in itself is the basis for a theological doctrine. And then to derive some questions from that for our general thinking, and perhaps draw some conclusions. Although that's not part of the guarantee that we'll draw conclusions. The guarantee is that we'll do some thinking that will stimulate some new thoughts and perhaps move us closer to some conclusions. subject that we're going to be looking at this morning really is physics. And as I mentioned, Jonathan Schell is a writer by profession. He's not a physicist. And I'm a theologian, more lately an administrator, and not a physicist. Now, if there are some physicists among you, I'd ask you to withhold your responses until I've completed that section on physics. And then if you can clarify or challenge, that would be helpful to us. I don't think it's inappropriate that non-physicists deal with the subject, because as you'll see, the subject is something that affects all of us. And the main thesis of the writer is that if we leave the subject only to the physicists, we will be taking a rather tremendous risk. The risk is there anyway, but certainly it's not something only for physicists to deal with. Okay, now I launch with some trepidation into a discussion of physics, and I'm depending rather heavily on Jonathan Schell for this. Jonathan Schell says that there are two basic forces that have determined the behavior of all matter on Earth, with some exceptions. But as far as we're concerned, these two basic forces have determined the behavior of all matter on Earth. And matter is these things, and it's the mountains, and it's our bodies, and everything that has that we can see and touch and feel. He said these two basic forces are, first of all, electromagnetic force. And electromagnetic force, he says, determines the patterns of the physical behavior of matter. So when matter moves or stays in a particular place, or the way in which it moves or stays, is determined in part by electromagnetic force. Electromagnetic force, among other things, is responsible for chemical bonding or genetic bonding. I think, if I understand it right, that yesterday afternoon we had the presentation on volcanoes, that when volcanoes erupt, that's electromagnetic force. The steam that gets caught and finally released, that's a part of electromagnetic force. So volcanoes and bombs historically and genetic bonding all somehow have to do with electromagnetic force. The other is gravitational force, and we think of gravitational force as the thing that keeps us on the Earth. Or if we're out into orbit, it's gravitational force that eventually brings the capsule back to Earth by entering back into the force of gravity. So gravitational force is the force of attraction between masses. And Schell says between the two of these forces, they've been responsible for virtually all life and motion on the Earth for 4.5 billion years. Now that's a rather sweeping statement, isn't it? Two forces responsible for everything and for 4.5 billion years. I'm not prepared to challenge those generalities, but just to point out that I realize that that is a rather gross generality. Now, there are two laws of physics that have gone with those, one being the law of conservation of energy and the other being the law of the conservation of mass. And generally, they say that you have energy on the one hand, heat would be one, steam power, this kind of energy that makes things go. And on the other hand, you've got mass or matter. They're separate. They're closed systems. You have so much energy existing, and you have so much mass existing, and things can happen to them. But the actual amounts don't change according to these two laws. Now, that is sometimes referred to as Newtonian physics. And as a matter of fact, almost all of the phenomenon that you and I are aware of, that we can see and are a part of and can experience and make sense of, can be taken care of by Newtonian physics, these two forces, electromagnetic and gravitation, and the laws of the conservation of energy and matter. Those two things account for practically everything that is a part of our experience. Volcanoes and birth and death and our moving about and dynamite and all those kinds of things. Anything that has to do with velocity or size or experience that are accounted by our senses. So sometimes Newtonian physics is called a human scale or Earth scale physics. Now, as a matter of fact, scientists by profession have been beyond Newtonian physics for the better part of this century. Einstein's law of relativity was the symbolic turning point from Newtonian to what is sometimes called Einsteinian physics. And yet I think most of us as lay people, non-scientists, as far as we're concerned, the Newtonian physics does for us, because it takes care of what we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. That the physicists, the scientists, have been beyond that for some time. Now, Einsteinian physics, you've heard of the quantum theory or the law of relativity, has to do with Einsteinian physics. And while Newtonian is Earth scale or human scale physics, Einsteinian physics is universe scale physics. And it has to do with those forces or matters that are outside of human experience. Things that are so large as to be cosmic in expanse, or so small as to be atomic or subatomic. So you can see why it is that it has to do with things that you and I don't experience. Atoms we know about, but we can do very well on a day-to-day basis without understanding atoms. So there's never anything that happens that causes us to question that very small kind of thing. And the cosmic forces are so far beyond what we can even think about that we aren't too concerned about it. But there were scientists like Einstein who began asking questions about those kinds of things. And at the subatomic level, the very small, or the cosmic, the very large, the Newtonian physics just didn't account for it. And so people who ask questions about why things are the way they are came upon a rather astounding thing. And the first being, as Einstein says, is that mass like this, which the old physics said was matter and would stay that way, that this is nothing other than latent energy. This rock, this chair, and my body, and everything else that is matter is a bundle of energy just waiting to be let loose. Now that challenges everything we had thought about matter. Einstein said, it's like a person with a great deal of wealth who never spent anything. And because that person with great wealth never spent anything, we never suspected that there was wealth there. Well, in this analogy, mass is the wealth, fabulously rich source of energy. But it never got spent, and so no one suspected that that energy was there until people began to probe and ask questions, Einstein among other them. And then he came up with this formula that probably all of us have seen many times, but most of us don't understand. E equals mc squared. You see what? Yeah, okay. Get it down here. E equals mc squared. Energy, E stands for energy, and m stands for mass, and c stands for the speed of light. Now, when you put the speed of light on there, you begin to see what he's driving at. Speed of light is 860,000 miles per second. Is that right? 186,000 miles per second. Now, give or take. Okay, now, then you square that. So 186,000 miles per second squared. Whatever that amount is, it's considerably larger than the kind of numbers we deal with. 3 gallons of gas, 2 dozen eggs, that kind of thing. Now, so what Einstein is saying is that if you compare energy to mass, how much energy is in this stone? Well, what you do is you say how much matter there is. You measure the amount of matter. And then you multiply that by 186,000 squared. And then you see how much energy is there. Okay. Now, that's pretty revolutionary when you begin to think about it. So that when you think of a person that we sometimes refer to as a bundle of energy, usually as small kids, we just don't realize what we're saying. If the all of the energy that was latent in that mass, which we call a little kid, were really let loose, then we would have a bundle of energy. All right. Now, there are two forces, then, that go along with this matter of Einsteinian physics. One is, this is very simple, strong force and weak force. Easy to say, difficult to understand. The strong force is the force that holds together the particles in the nucleus of an atom. Okay, we're getting pretty small now. But in other words, the strong force is the things that keeps all of that energy latent in the matter, keeps it latent. It holds it together. The protons and the neutrons that make up the nucleus of the atom are the energy, but the strong force is the thing that holds it together, keeps that energy in there. The weak force is the force that causes the decay of radioactive material. Radioactive material is a part of the universe, and the force, the weak force, causes that to break down over time. And if things were let alone, over a period of millions and billions of years, gradually all of the radioactive energy would finally have worn down because of this weak force. Okay. Now, what was discovered as a result of this kind of thinking was that the strong force, this binding action of the strong force, can actually be broken apart. And by breaking the hold of the strong force, all of this energy that is latent can be let loose. The phrase is nuclear fission and nuclear fusion are two ways by which this energy can be let loose. In the one process, you break apart the nuclei. And when that happens, you kind of break the force of the strong force and you get this explosion of energy. Or by nuclear fusion, you somehow, by massing it together, compressing it, you break the bonds and the energy is let loose. It is not only that initial force of breaking the bonds of the strong force that happens, but in that process, you also let loose a lot of radioactive material, which then has to be deactivated over a period of time. So that can add to the radioactive matter in the universe. And you set up a whole additional mass that only over time will break down. So it's new things happening relative to the strong force and the weak force. And now what Jonathan Schell wants to tell us is that this is not something just interesting and just another piece of scientific or technological progress in the history of the human species. But at the point where we discovered the energy and then figured out how to let loose the energy and then to mechanize that in such a way that we could do things with it, we entered into a qualitatively different era of history, both for the Earth and the human species. And the statistic that made this most graphic for me was that Schell points out that when the bomb that exploded over Hiroshima in 1945, the energy that was let loose was the energy that was contained in 1 gram or 1/30th of an ounce of matter. Now that's so you can see how this thing really works. So that the bomb itself weighed 4 tons, but it wasn't the bomb from which the energy came. It was that 1 gram of matter that was the source of all of the energy in that explosion over Hiroshima. And by the other way of thinking, that is when we're dealing with electromagnetic power or force, then we would need 12,500 tons of TNT to duplicate the power or the energy that came out of that 1 ounce of matter. All right, so that Shell wants to tell us that by the discovery and the application of the understanding of the energy that is present in matter, we let loose a form of power that previously had been known only outside of the Earth, out in the cosmos somewhere. This kind of energy, this kind of force is at loose. But never before had that amount of energy been let loose on the Earth. Said actually there was one exception in a uranium mine in South Africa. There is on record a chain reaction similar to the nuclear. But with that exception, never before. And in fact, Shell points out that it's only because this kind of energy had never been let loose that life on Earth as we understand it ever had a chance to develop. That that energy was contained, the whole creation or evolutionary process, which eventually culminates in the human species, that was able to take place because this other energy was contained. So now, and Harry Truman mentioned this at the time the bomb was exploded over Hiroshima, what we have done is unleashed upon Earth the basic power of the universe. And we let loose that power which is of a magnitude which is appropriate only to the cosmos, have let loose on the tiny, frail ecosphere of Earth. A mismatch which Shell calls of monstrous disproportion. And I'll read a paragraph here. Let's see. He said, the monstrous disproportion between the basic power of the universe and the merely terrestrial creatures by which and against which it was aimed in anger define the dread predicament that the world has tried and failed to come to terms with ever since. So he's saying at the point that the knowledge and the application of that knowledge took place, from that very point, we had the risk and the need to contain the power. We didn't need to get to 1982 to be worried about this, but at the very point we began to understand the energy and to apply it, at that point we needed to be thinking about dealing with it. And his point is that while we have perfected the technology and increased the number of weapons which use this kind of energy, we have not been able by political, philosophical, ethical means to come up with the appropriate controls for it. And he says that what happened at Hiroshima was less than 1/1,000,000th the part of the energy that could be let loose if all of the energy in the present nuclear weaponry of the world were let loose. So Hiroshima becomes the thing by which we can get some idea of what happens, but really not much of an idea at all, because that's just 1/1,000,000th of what could take place. And then he adds one more thing on this thought, and that is that in really attempting to understand what would happen if all of this energy were let loose, he said that the point is that in fact what we know about it is less than what we don't know about it. Because we're dealing with something that we really can't experiment with. You can't have a pilot test of what would happen if we let loose all this energy. And the scary thing for him is not so much what we know will happen, but what we don't know about that kind of a thing. So it's the surprises that we have been confronted with when whatever detonation or release of those energies have taken place that cause us to say it's not what we know, but it's what we don't know about it. Now, from Jonathan Shell, I think the point that we're looking at is not to be fascinated by this more powerful kind of TNT or energy or the more sophisticated level of weaponry, but the new level of existence that it puts us on. In other words, we've got something entirely different to deal with, something which was previously unknown, for which we're not prepared, and without which we don't have the proportionate knowledge and the technology and the political intelligence to control. What I'd like to suggest is that while the author says that what we have here is a mismatch between nuclear power and the earthly arena, I'd like to suggest is a mismatch between nuclear power and the human species. Mismatch between nuclear power and the human species that has discovered and unleashed it, and now must find some way to contain it. That's where the mismatch is. Power on the one hand, and those of us, the species, that have discovered it and let loose. We are not the match for what we've come up with. Now, let me ask if there is anyone, I want to move on to the next thought, which has to do with a theological understanding or a particular biblical passage that I begin to connect with this. But does anyone know anything about this that would say that we need to, that we have any basic misconceptions operating here? And I don't want to continue on a premise that's, that someone knows is absolutely wrong. Yeah.
No problem. The problem is with premise. The C is this speed of light, centimeters per second, not miles per second. Just a clarification.
What is it?
In centimeters, centimeters per second. And I don't know what it is.
I'll check that. Check my source and see if I read the source wrong or if the source may be wrong. Okay. It's a lot, anyway. Right, now, as I thought about this, it began to occur that I had read something like this before somewhere else. And here's what I was reminded of. Then God said, let us make man, since we're using the word term human species, let's use that. Let us make the human species in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created the human species in his own image. In the image of God, he created it. Male and female, he created it. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant-yielding seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed and its fruit, you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Then it goes on. The Lord God took the man, and I assume the woman, and put them in the Garden of Eden to till it and keep it. And the Lord God commanded them, saying, you may freely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall die. And continuing further on, now the serpent was more subtle than any other wild creature that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, God say you shall not eat of any tree of the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. But God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. But the serpent said to the woman, you will not die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband, and he ate. And then one step further.
in the story. To the woman, God said. It also says something to the serpent, but we're not in that, so we'll deal with what he said to the woman and to the man. To the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbearing, because you've eaten of the tree. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And to Adam he said, because you've listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth to you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. You are dust, and to dust you shall return.
Now that, you've read that too, and have heard it. And what is suggested to me by this account in Genesis is, first of all, that all creation is good. And I'll suggest a couple of other words for good. All creation is complete. And I'm not claiming to deal with the Hebrew word here, but I think in terms of what we think of as good. Complete, or another word, has value. So if we're asking about all these things that we've been dealing with, the rocks and our bodies and the volcanoes and the laws of energy and matter and so on, all of creation is good. That's our basic starting point from this story. And there's a sense in there in which it's complete. It's all there to be lived with and to be enjoyed. And it has value. There's worth there. A second thing that comes through in this is that there are limits that are placed upon the human species. It's all there for you to enjoy and to be a part of and to take care of, except you shall not eat of this one tree, the fruit of the one tree. There's a limit that is set upon there. And that's very clear. God turns it all over to the human species, but there is a limit to what it can be done. But at the same time, there is the freedom to test the limits. It's also clear that the human species can say, I understand that there are those limits there, but it's also possible for me to say, am I really limited? Is it really wrong for me to do this? Can I go ahead and do it anyway? And that kind of thinking, that's there. And then the third thing is that the human species did immediately test and even exceed the limit. That was referred to the fall. And the fall immediately has serious consequences. In fact, that consequence is called a curse. A curse is placed upon the human species because they exceeded the limits. So all of this is in that story of the very first chapters in Genesis, after creation came into being. If the creation is there, it's good. It's turned over to the human species just to live with and to be a part of, enjoy. There are limits set on them. They have the freedom to test it. They do it. And we have what we refer to as the fall and the consequences which follow. Eve is to bear children in pain, is to have to contend with her husband. Adam is going to have to scratch for a living. And it's going to be hard work, and he's going to have to keep at it until he dies, and indeed he will die, and then return to it. And therefore, the fall and the consequences interrupt the creation that was good and complete. Not that it is no longer good or complete or has value, but it's just not the way it was as it was turned over to the human species. So another way of saying this is that at the very beginning, the Bible tells us, and then our theological development after that, that almost immediately the human species set out on a course of self-destruction, which both, thinking of ourselves as individuals and as communities, seems to put us continually on the edge of self-destruction, right at the beginning, because of this
this need to test the limits. We find ourselves almost constantly on the edge of self-destruction. And so one way of thinking about what Jonathan Schell is telling us in the light of Scripture is to say that there is a straight line over a period of time, a straight line that runs from the eating of the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden to unleashing the power that was latent within matter. And there's a curse. Just as the curse is put upon Adam and Eve for exceeding the limits in their time, we can think of the curse put on the human species because of exceeding the limit in this time. So in this case, the curse being that of being on the edge of complete self-destruction. And this is why I've referred to this as the second fall and outdoing Adam and Eve, because what we've gotten ourselves into this time has consequences which, as I say, are in a straight line. It's not a different kind of thing, but it's far, far more vast than that of the curse of Adam and Eve. Now, this raises any number of questions. And as I said, there's much more in this first chapter of Jonathan Schell, and I encourage you to read the whole thing because there's more detail about the nature and the possibilities of nuclear energy than you really want to know, but no less than we need to know. So that's why I recommend that you read it. But just taking this one thought, that for me, what Jonathan Schell has done in this one section of the first chapter, when it begins to touch off some connections with the first chapter of Genesis, says that once we accept the reality of nuclear power, we need to ask about the meaning. And one of the meanings that is latent in there for me is that we are once again confronted with the fact that we are a limited species, that everything is not possible, or if it is possible, is not necessarily desirable. And the question is, what are the limits that are placed upon them? What are the limits within which we need to stay? And what are those beyond which we ought not to go or ought not try to go? And what about the consequences that follow from it? Now, I'm stating those assertions, but let's, because I'm saying that the discovery of energy latent in matter, and then the application of them, I am saying, is an example of the human species testing and exceeding the limits that are put on us. Now, that may be open to debate. You may want to say, no, that is not testing the limits. But that's still within the limits of the human species. But let's think about limits for a minute. We've got a few minutes to give some thought. When you think about yourself and life as you understand it, can you think of some limits that are put upon you that, as far as you know, you can't get away from? In other words, no matter... you can think about getting out of those limits. But what, can you think of any offhand, what would be a, what do you put to say that?
Flying.
Okay, you can't fly, you can't decide right now to flap your wings. Okay, that's because of this gravitational force. Yeah?
Aging.
All right. It does seem that aging is a part of the experience of the human species. And, that's one of those things that we're testing the limits of, isn't it? Is to see if we can somehow get beyond that. In cryonics, this idea of freezing a person just before the moment of death is a way to see if we might over time get away from that. So far, that seems to be something that limits us. Yeah?
Physical limits that we need fuel to take in a few weeks.
Okay. Or basically that we have to live in a body. And that body needs a continual supply of energy or fuel. So far, we haven't figured a way to live outside of the body. Very basic, but serious limitation. Yeah.
Well, I just think of Psalm 8, it talks about we're not gods, we're not animals, we're in between,
yeah.
we're human beings. And like you said, we require a certain context within which to live. And that's the limit.
And that also places limits on us. That is, as being in between, we cannot act as if we are animal life. We could decide to live like dogs and bears and eagles. We can't fly like an eagle. But because we have the understanding, the intellect, we can't get ourselves fully into that. So we can never live solely as animals, nor can we be as God. And so one way of putting it is that, as far as we know at least, animals do not have the conscious ability to make choices, to test limits consciously. We can. And that's a limit to be able to make those choices. Because on the other hand, we're not God, which means we never can know perfectly in advance the full consequences of our choices. So that's another one of our limits, the limitation of not knowing for sure whether we have made the right decision or even the decision that needs to be made. So there are some things that we haven't figured a way of getting out of, at least. So we are limited, and if we try to act as if we don't have those limits, there are serious consequences. We live as if we don't have to eat. We eventually die. Or if we live as if we can soar like an eagle, we crash. Now, are there some other limits that perhaps we ought not to test or to move beyond? That is, things that actually we can do, but perhaps we ought not to. We have to think of some things that we already have done that we could say, even though obviously we're able to do it, we ought not to have done. Any thoughts on that? Yeah, now why would you say that that is something we ought not to have done?
I didn't say that, but there are a lot of people who say we have gotten business up for the
moment. Right. So that would be a question. I mean, we have gotten ourselves out of the gravitational pull of the Earth, to get ourselves out into orbit and get to the moon. Now that may be a question area. Is that a case of having gone too far?
So I understand, and I'm not perfectly sure, I will stand to be corrected, that you can set off a limited amount of atoms, but when you go beyond a certain point, man no longer controls it, but it is spontaneous, and we can destroy the world.
Right. Okay.
Am I on the right premise?
Now, why? What is the? What have we done there by exceeding that?
No, we'll destroy ourselves. We will also destroy the earth as we know it.
All right. So there's a question: whether or not. We know, even before we discovered nuclear energy, that we could damage the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
We found out that we could tear it up, destroy the ecology. I'm struck every time I walk down the road and look up at this mine. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of a fascination to it. There is a beauty to that. And yet it's a real scar on the landscape, and then this heap of peelings. Well, obviously the human species was quite able to do that. In weighing the fate of the earth, and with it our own fate, we stand before a mystery. And in tampering with the earth, we tamper with a mystery. We are in deep ignorance. Our ignorance should dispose us to wonder, and our wonder should make us humble. Our humility should inspire us to reverence and caution, and our reverence and caution should lead us to act without delay, to withdraw the threat we now pose to the earth and to ourselves.